With my double-bladed axe and my hobnail boots, I go where the timber's tall. When there's work to be done, don't mess around, just sing right out for call.
Okay, well, we're all familiar with that version of Paul Bunyan. That's the Disney version, by the way, in case you're wondering. But did you know that that version of Paul Bunyan was originally created for a lumber company advertisement? Because Paul Bunyan had a dark side, too. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And here to talk about the myths and the real lives of lumberjacks is Willa Hammett Brown, the author of the new book, Gentlemen in the Woods, Manhood, Myth, and the American Lumberjack. What questions or comments do you have about logging or lumberjacks? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Willa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jill.
You bet. You know, it was kind of funny when I first started reading your book. I'm like, wow, she's got the same kind of background as I do. I had a great-grandfather who was a lumberjack who came in from Canada, not Scandinavia like yours did. So it was very interesting for me to read your book. But let's just talk first about that whole Paul Bunyan thing. I know you don't really get to it till later on, but I think people are probably intrigued. It's like, what do you mean that Paul Bunyan had a dark side? So tell us about that.
Absolutely. So Paul Bunyan is totally fascinating to me, and in some ways extra special American because of this, because he is often cited as sort of the great American folk hero. There have been operas written about him. He was the decoration for World's Fair American stands, but he's a commercial invention, which that just feels very American to me. So Paul Bunyan did exist in a few stories in the late 19th century. The earliest written story of him is from about 1890. And that Paul Bunyan was a jerk. He was real mean. He was nothing like the sort of Disneyfied version. The first story that ever was circulated and printed about him was one called The Round River Drive, where he just made his men take logs around and around and around and around the same river so that he would never have to pay them. So that's not the lumberjack we know and love. And it was a researcher at the Wisconsin Historical Society, which a lot of my research was in Wisconsin, the great state of. I live in Minnesota, but I have nothing but respect for our neighbors. A man named Michael Edmonds, who was an archivist there, who really turned me on to looking at the roots of lumber of Paul Bunyan and where he came from. And his first popularization was as an ad for the Red River Lumber Company. A man named William Lawhead had worked a bit in the camps, had heard a bunch of tall tales, and he sort of collected them, sanitized them, and put Paul Bunyan, slapped him on them, and made this cheerful, sweet guy, sometimes a little bumbling, but mostly good-hearted, with his beautiful, like, gang of lumberjacks out in the woods having a good time. And that's the one that took over. And it meant that we, in the wake of that, erased a lot of the real history of what those men had been like and how they had been seen. Because instead we had this easy, friendly symbol that we all became very familiar with.
And it's still out there. There's a lot of places where that, well, for some reason he kept growing. This huge Paul Bunyan is out there to greet vacationers in most cases, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All over sort of the three states I worked on were Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. But there are also Paul Bunyans in California, in Washington State, in Maine, anywhere where lumber was huge. And then I sort of think of Paul Bunyan as standing in for this whole phenomenon of lumberjacks that might not be specifically Paul Bunyan. But you think about the brawny paper towel guy, or the lumberjack that's in the ads for the Duluth Trading Company. Or if my favorite, the only reason the Monty Python Lumberjack song is so funny is because we quote unquote know what real lumberjacks were like. And so it makes it hilarious that they press wildflowers and wear suspenders and a bra because we have this idea of what they're like.
Right, exactly. I thought it was interesting too that where was I going with this? Well, actually, we've got a call. Let's go to a call first, and maybe I'll remember what I was going to say. Stephen Rhinelander, go right ahead.
Good morning. My great-grandfather left home at age 14 in 1884 when his mother died and moved to northern Wisconsin to work in the woods. And the next three generations were northern Wisconsin loggers. I still own family land in Price County. Every time I go up north, I can't help but see the damage to the land and the rivers. And I wanted to thank the author for her skill and courage in speaking the truth about the history here. I still love and respect my ancestors, but I want my kids to know they were exploited Eastern European immigrants, and just only a few people got super rich.
Mm-hmm. Truth, for
absolutely.
Sure.
And that's what so much of the sort of Paul Bunyan myth covers over, is it makes us think of it as this sort of small-scale friendly industry, when really it looked so much more like Western mining or oil rigs or any of these extractive industries that we know were exploitative and we know were super centralized and we know had a bottom layer of workers who had no hope of moving up. But that industry kind of got disappeared, and so did, as you say, that incredible environmental damage. We don't talk or think about the logging of this region as one of the greatest environmental reshapings and disasters in American history. Also, I'm so glad somebody from Rhinelander called. I don't know if you know that you are the home of the Hodag.
Oh, they know.
I've never actually been to Rhinelander myself, but as soon as I heard the name, I was thrilled.
There's a lovely statue, and there used to be Hodag days. I'm not sure if there still is, but oh yeah, they know.
They're aware.
They're very aware. The Hodag. Yeah, we can talk a little bit about that, too, because you do mention that in your book. And what I was going to ask you about earlier that I completely spaced, conservation. So we've got Paul Bunyan, who's, you know, looking like a conservationist, representing a group of organizations, mm-hmm. people, whatever, that clear cut so many acres of land. In my mind, I never thought about that. It's like, why are we talking about this person who obviously, you know, cut down all these trees, but he's always surrounded by them and everything we hear and see. So was that kind of a surprise to you too? Had you really thought about it before?
I had absolutely not thought about it before. And it becomes this really prevalent image when this region starts selling itself as a tourist destination. Because the thing is, you can't sell as a tourist destination what the Northwoods looked like in 1900, 1910, which is just miles of stumps. But you also can't really deny that the logging industry existed. And this sort of Paul Bunyan-y lumberjack manages to bridge that gap. It manages to make it look like lumberjacks existed and logged here, but they never destroyed their woods. They were part of the woods. They were more working with the woods, like sailors and the sea or farmers and the land, this sort of organic connection. And the truth of the matter is everything we see up north now is second growth forest. In Minnesota, for instance, there is only one 40-acre plot of original white pine stand in the entire state. It only exists because there was an accident in a surveying trip and it was surveyed as under a lake. And so no one could buy the rights to it. But that's it. That's it. And so you start seeing in the 50s and 60s, this sort of come see the virgin wilderness untouched by any human hands. And yet they're advertising on the same thing. They'll say untouched. And then they'll have a lumberjack and a sort of stereotypical Native American standing in for the Menominee or the Anishinaabe. And there's this weird dichotomy that exists in the American mind around things like cowboys and lumberjacks, and that is similar to what exists around Native Americans, which is this idea we have that they could be both, the land could be occupied by people but untouched by man.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff to uncover in that particular conversation. But let's go to Carol in Appleton, and she has something for us. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi. Back in the 1980s, like early 80s, I was a student at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. And one of my volunteer opportunities, I visited a woman who was about 100 back then in a nursing home. And she used to tell me the best stories. And one of her stories was that at Stevens Point, the town, the loggers would come down from up north and cash their checks. And she said it was like the Wild West. When they would come into town, I guess there were gunfights and they had brothels, and it was a pretty happening place to be.
Yes. Oh, Carol, I'm so glad you brought that up. And it's so fun to hear of somebody having those memories. I have heard those memories all secondhand through largely WPA interviews that were done in the 1930s. But it was there, a man named Jeremy Kalar did some studies and found that the Michigan lumber towns were as violent, if not more violent, than the Wild West cow towns. And what you're describing was nicknamed the Spree, which was, logging was always done in the winter because before we had steam power and gas power in the woods, we were using horses, which meant sliding on ice was the only way to move these enormous logs. And then when it thawed, they would come into town, and the descriptions are like some sort of wild natural phenomenon. They talk about them as like locusts, that there was nothing you could do about it. A lot of people would say the only thing to do was just lock your doors and stay inside, because they were going to come, they were going to spend their money. And what eventually towns did as they were trying to make themselves more and more respectable is they start building neighborhoods to try to contain them. They sort of think of them as you can't stop it, and it's going to infect the morals of the town, these terrible, terrible men, which again, now we're seeing that real contrast with Paul Bunyan. But these awful men are going to infect the morals of the town. So they build basically quarantine zones. In fact, the term skid row as a bad part of town comes from a logging term. A skid row is part of a camp. It's where the logs are skidded down to the lake. And those areas were just full of brothels and taverns, and largely the police let what happened happen as long as it didn't come into the rest of the town. So yeah, we don't get much of that sense anymore. A lot of people in those towns tried to cover it up. There's a bunch of great angry newspaper letters in the 1940s about Seney, Michigan. This guy saying there wasn't a single prostitute in all of the Upper Peninsula. No, there were so many. So many.
That anyone would believe that is beyond me. And you'd mentioned Seney, and that's not too far from where I grew up, but there's like not much of anything left there. But at one point, there were a lot of people there, all because of the lumber industry, right?
Seney was really fun for me to visit. That was one of my favorite research stops. It is it comes up in story after story after story. And then when you go to Seney now, I don't think there's even a stoplight at the crossroads. And there's a gas station, a couple stores. I went to see their historical museum, and it involved going to the county office and then being sent to a gym and finding this one guy who had the key. But what I loved, because these towns were so small, this was really fun. I was in the Seney Historical Museum, and I'm looking at these photos. And there's a photo of the Women's Woodwind Society. This is sort of, you know, respectable middle class, all these ladies sitting in their proper little band. And then in a different part, there's a photo of sort of the worst row of town where all the brothels were. And there are these women waving from the top floor of hotels. And wouldn't you know, some of them are the same women. But the town was too small for you to put together a woodwind band without a few prostitutes in it.
Right. There was a lot of stuff like that in your book that I found quite interesting, entertaining, and really kind of funny in a sad way. And their pictures are wonderful. There's a lot of really nice pictures in there, and there's a couple of sections with full color. Mm-hmm. But how did you find all those really interesting pictures, and how did you maybe even filter out some of them? Because I'm sure you found a lot more.
So huge amounts of credit here has to go to my editor, Christian Tvedin at the University of Minnesota Press. He has a background in art history, and he got very excited about the images with me. And I would say in the end, while I came to him with images, probably only 20% of the images in the book are ones that I brought to him. The rest are ones he brought to me. He kept finding all of these incredible images. A lot of them are from the University of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Historical Society just have these incredible banks of images. And I also used images a lot in research. My research method is I should never give grad students advice. I was getting my PhD, and they sort of say, you know, to carefully get this narrow question and then find the three archives you're going to go to. And my question was lumberjacks? Question mark. And my sources were like anything. So I used a lot of images, and images are really fun to work with because they tell stories that you don't get in the words, especially when you're working with a group like lumberjacks who are largely illiterate and largely despised in their own time. We don't write a lot about that kind of person. So it's both a huge challenge and a lot of fun to try to get at the lives of people who were not written about.
We're talking with Willa Hammett Brown. She's an historian, speaker, and writer, and the author of the new book, Gentlemen in the Woods, Manhood, Myth, and the American Lumberjack. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have a question or comment. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Right now, we are talking about lumberjacks. And let's go to Kay in Maryland, Wisconsin. Go right ahead, Kay.
Hi. Maryland was started as a lumber town. The guy that came here, seen all the forest, and thought, oh, my God, I could be rich. So my question is, from our area in Jackson County over to Rapids down to the Dells area. That was the nesting area for the passenger pigeons. And then they clear cut. And that is supposed to be why we no longer have passenger pigeons, why they went extinct. Is that true?
Have you did any kind of looking into that at all, Willow?
I haven't looked specifically into the passenger pigeons. What's very funny to me right now is that my uncle wrote a book called Pigeons and People about the extinction of the passenger pigeon. And I read it when I was about 12. So I'm trying to remember. But what I can tell you that the ecological disaster of that region did lead to a lot of extinctions of species and did lead to a lot of migratory patterns of species having to change. The scale of the lumbering is really, really hard to imagine or understand just because we haven't done anything like it. And that part of sort of central Wisconsin was the most devastated of the entire region. In fact, people don't talk about it a lot, but in the late 1920s, early 1930s, there was a second smaller dust bowl than the one in Oklahoma in Wisconsin. And during the 1930s, even though only about 10% of the population of Wisconsin lived in the area, over 75% of government aid was going to that area because it had been so ecologically devastated by this industry. And also by it, as the industry receded, they attempted to sell the land and they sold it through a lot of lies. And one of those lies was that all of this was the most beautiful, the richest farmland. But the thing is, pines grow in sandy soil. So if there were a lot of pines there, then you're not going to have soil that's good for a lot other than pines. And you're also going to loosen that soil when you cut down the pines. You're going to lose those root systems. And so we lost huge areas, vast swaths of these regions to dust bowls and fires throughout the, really starting in the 1870s and going all the way through the 1930s.
And let's talk about the result of that in another area, which is wildfires. Yeah. They were devastating. And I know here in Wisconsin, of course, we know about the Peshtigo fire. Why don't you talk a little bit about those fires and the effects of yeah. logging and why that happened?
Yeah, I mean, outside Wisconsin, a huge number of people have never heard of Peshtigo, which Peshtigo is to this day the deadliest fire in American history. Historians disagree. Early claims were that it claimed 1,200 lives. Estimates go up as high as 3,000 lives. It happened to happen the same day as the Great Chicago Fire. So it kind of got swept aside by history, because while Chicago actually destroyed a far smaller area and killed many fewer people, it was flashier. It was Chicago. And Peshtigo got swept aside. But if you look at it still, 4 out of the 10 deadliest fires in American history were during this region in this area. The Thumb Fire in Michigan, there were the Cloquet Fire in Minnesota. And a lot of these fires, they got blamed at the time on either accident or blamed on people doing bad protocol and leaving too many logs piled here or there. But really, even if you had a big pile of drying logs by a railroad, which is how it often started with a railroad spark, the problem was that as the industry went, they would clear cut, and anything that wasn't worth saving, they would just leave. And so you have these miles and miles of drying slash, and those would catch fire incredibly quickly and in devastating huge fires that covered overall an area almost the size of Delaware burned over this sort of 40-year period. So these enormous, enormous wildfires that absolutely devastated the region and yet have been kind of misplaced in history. I didn't learn about them until I started studying this myself. You know, and that was, I have a PhD in American history, and it wouldn't have come up if it weren't for the fact that I was studying this particular region myself.
Let's go back to the phones. Todd in De Pere, go ahead, please.
Hi, good morning. Looking forward to reading your book. I want to talk about two publications. One, my mother-in-law found at a rummage sale. It's The Forestry Primer by the American Tree Association from 1876 to 1926. And it speaks of basically the turning point to modern forestry practices. And it does mention the forest fires in the United States, which just dwarfed even the large fires in California. The other book I'd like to mention, very hard to find, an old book, is called A Wisconsin Lumberman Looks Backwards by William Holtz. They own a lumber company in Ocano. And they speak a lot of the areas in northern Wisconsin, which are dear to my heart. I used to live up there, and I recognize a lot of the old names. Just an interesting, interesting publication, an interesting book, if you can find it.
Thank you, Todd. We really appreciate that. Are those new to you, Willa?
The Wisconsin Lumberman Looks Backward, I have seen. The Forestry Primer is new to me. That is the sort of key moment of change. And the first change was as small as changing the way teeth worked on a saw that allowed saws to go much faster, crosscut saws. And then really the change comes with mechanization, with the introduction of steam engines. So you're using trains instead of rivers. And then eventually you're using tractors instead of horses. And that changes the game entirely. If people want to read the sort of original sources and get a sense of it, one that is better available is a book called Holy Old Mackinaw. And that is written by a lumberman looking sort of back at his own experience and can be a fun way into the more colorful details. Although I will say that I pulled a lot of the most colorful details I could find and put them in the book. There's a section where I describe the smell of a logging camp that has been described to me by one of my best friends as visceral and by my uncle as nauseating. So I tried to keep some of that detail there in the book.
Well, you got to describe what one of those logging camps was like, so people can probably get into their mind what it actually smelled like.
Oh, yeah. Bad. I mean, that was bad. So if you're talking about the height of it, at the very early on, camps would be very small. They would be an owner clearing a plot with 5 or 6 men helping them out. But by the time we get to sort of industrial scale logging, the camps had proliferated into a sort of set number of buildings. There would be a cook shack where the men would eat. They would normally have about 15 minutes a meal. Lunch was brought to them where they were cutting. So it would be breakfast before dawn, and dinner after nightfall, no talking, 15 minutes in and out. The cooks were really revered because almost all the camps paid the same. So men the only reason they'd stay is if they were treated well, because there was normally more work than men. So a lot of them would vote with their feet if the cook was bad and just go find another camp. Then there would be a hut where the scaler, the sort of educated men of the camp, so the foreman and the people who did the counting and the numbers, lived. There'd be a blacksmith. And then there would be the main shanty, and it would have somewhere between 50 and 120 men. They would sleep in long bunks side to side, sometimes with sort of single blankets covering a dozen of them, big long blankets. The smell part comes from the fact that, first of all, some men were known to put on their long underwear at the beginning of winter and take it off at the end and never in between. And at the end of a day, you would come back and your socks would be wet. So they would hang those over. There'd be a big iron stove in the middle for heating, and you'd hang your socks there. So you just have to imagine 100 pairs of wet socks steaming into a poorly ventilated space with 100 unwashed men bedding down for the night. And you begin to get a sense of how deeply unpleasant these conditions were.
Especially when you remember they were out all day sweating profusely. Mm-hmm. So yep. Yes, absolutely. Let's go to Jerry in Prairie du Chien. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you for accepting my call. I've just tuned in late, but I wondered if your guest knew about the Bermuda Triangle of northern Wisconsin. Namely, it was called Hurley, Hayward, and Hell.
I know Hurley, Hayward. I know that area. I have not heard it called the Bermuda Triangle. I love that. There are these regions in each state. So I sort of think of Hurley, Wisconsin being the Sini of Wisconsin. And then Minnesota, it's sort of around Deer River, which is where actually I've spent every summer of my life and now is a town of 800 and perfectly respectable. But Hurley and Hayward were some of the roughest Wisconsin towns, just filled with lumberjacks and filled with the brothels that held these sprees, taverns and brothels. And those are also areas, a lot of them, that now have reclaimed that as a real point of pride. Hayward is where the World Lumberjack Games are. So these areas have now really come to reclaim it. But at the time, they were not exactly respectable. And the year-round citizens were doing anything they could to try to keep the lumberjacks either out of town or at least contained where they were safe. And they could just fight each other and not get into the town.
And Jerry, did you have a comment about a logging antique that you have?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, my uncle was aware of at least an old logging site in Douglas County, and there he found a Copenhagen snuff jar. It's out of a crock material, like the same type of material that the Red Wing crocks are made out of, and he gifted that to me. It's about 5 inches tall and in very pale blue print, still visible on the jar, is the name Copenhagen. So I'm very fond of that. Just not that I use tobacco, but it was a gift from my favorite uncle, and I'm happy to have it.
Thank you, Jerry.
Heirloom.
Right? Yeah, for sure. Let's go to Ann in Madison. Go ahead, Ann.
Hi. My grandfather and his brother Pete were both lumberjacks up somewhere in northern Wisconsin. And my grandmother was a cook in that camp. Boucha and Grandpa married, and Grandpa and his father built their house, and they lived there their whole life. In Edgar. Grandpa used to tell us stories of Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox. And Paul Bunyan, he said, was buried, and his feet are where Rib Mountain is.
That's so fun. Thank you, Anne. I appreciate that. My grandmother was a cook in a lumber camp, too, when she was quite young. That was in the 20s, though. So things were changing at that point. So talk a little bit about that. So we've got the very early part where you had mentioned that there were smaller tracks that were being taken down. And then the lumber barons came in. So what happened at that point and after?
So when the lumber barons come in, the very early things are people are either buying small tracts of land or they are straight stealing it from the Anishinaabe and the Menominee with assumptions that they could get away with it. And they were successful in doing so. And you could go in with very little capital to start up. By the 1890s, you're buying up bigger and bigger tracts of land. Several treaties have essentially wrested control of almost all the indigenous owned land. The Menominee were actually really successful at keeping a patch of land and logging it themselves. The Anishinaabe didn't have a centralized leadership and got swindled harder. And so you start having men come in with a lot of capital in order to, if you think about it, I'm describing that early camp, you have a little log cabin with 12 guys. If you need to build four or five buildings, including having a fully working cook shack and a fully working smithy, you need a lot more money. And so it gets centralized and they get bigger and bigger. And then in about 1916, really, is when labor unrest starts. And you start having at the same time more ability to use tractors in the woods, and it really changes. So by 1920, the men would be sleeping on beds with springs. There are a lot of great memoirs and stories of people in the 1930s talking about, you know, these young bucks, they're so soft. They're not real lumberjacks. They have springs on their bed. They have running water. They wash every day. That's not a real lumberjack. And you have much more control from the top, these multiple camps owned by one person. And that's when you really get, starting in sort of the 1880s, when it starts being more or less impossible to sort of bootstrap your way up from the bottom to the top. If you're at the bottom of the structure and working as a jack, you're not going to end up owning.
A lot of times, and sometimes they own the towns where the logs came in. That was the case where I grew up. And when the trees were pretty much gone, they sold the town. So very, very interesting. Thomas in Manitowoc, go right ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to know what time of year did these guys start logging, and when did they usually end? Because my grandfather, he was a home builder, and in the winter back in the old days, he was off, and he would go back up north and lumberjack. It's from what I understand, it wasn't that long of a season because they had to float the logs down the rivers when the water was high, and it's amazing they could cut all those trees down in that short of a season.
Yeah, the seasons were quite short. The camp would be built before the freeze, but men would be sent up as soon as snow was on the ground. We have to remember that these last few winters are climate change winters, so that was earlier than it would be now, but still at the earliest, late October, mid-October. And then they would pile the logs next to the river, and as soon as the river ice broke up, and the water was high, as you say, those logs would be shoved in for the drive, which was the last part of the season. So you could start work early if you were building the camp, but then a jack would work from sort of mid-October until the spring breakup, and then river pigs, they were called, would take over, which were sometimes lumberjacks, sometimes not. And they would do the drive, which was the most dangerous, but also the best paid part of the process. And then those men would go do something else. And a lot of lumberjacks sort of believed that a true lumberjack didn't go back to a farm in his family. Those were guys who might spend a winter or two. But instead, somebody might go to house building. A lot of them would do what was called grass backing, which was to go out to the Dakotas and work on farms. And then they would come back and show up in cities in the fall and wait to be sent back out to the camps.
It's a crazy life for sure. I mean, that we kind of get, like you had mentioned, hobos and tramps and what were the other one? There was three of them, right? Hobos, tramps, I'm not going to say thieves. But anyway, that's kind of where that comes from, right? Is that these itinerant workers are just kind of going all over the country.
Yeah, and itinerant workers then, and I think notably now, we're blamed for a lot of things. The idea, especially in the late 19th century, was that men have these sort of dangerous natural urges, and the thing that keeps them safe and respectable is their self-restraint, which was very, very important, and family, women, wives, mothers, daughters. And so transient workers were really distrusted because the idea was that they had no attachment to the community, and they might do anything. And I think you can really see that these ideas have not gone away. The workers were considered racially other, notably whiteness here and race has nothing to do with skin color. I have a letter from a guy named Glenn Horace writing home to his mom that there were 15 white men and 60 Swedes in his camp. The idea that Scandinavians or Eastern Europeans were sort of racially other, unassimilable, and passing through with no wives, no families to restrain them. And I think you can look at the way we talk about migrant workers today and see a lot of parallels in this scapegoating and fear that these people aren't committed enough to the community and might therefore be a danger.
I thought that was interesting, too, because when we think of migrants, obviously in this time frame, we think of other people than we do people from Sweden or Finland or Denmark or what have you. So it kind of just shows the different ways that we look at these things. Let's talk a little bit about the Native American tribes that were affected by this land grab, number one, and that some of them actually did work with the companies.
Yeah, absolutely. The Anishinaabe were probably the most affected and the most likely to be in camps. The land grab was devastating and went through several stages. Some of them were treaties to buy, and then eventually you get what is still remembered among the Ojibwe Anishinaabe as the White Earth Tragedy, which is there was this new reservation created called White Earth, and then the Dawes Act in 1882 said, we can't hold this land in common. Everybody has to get a plot. But each plot was not big enough to make a living off. So then those plots were sold off to timbermen because they couldn't actually support a family. The way the Anishinaabe interacted with the camps is actually really interesting to me in a couple of ways. From the Anishinaabe point of view, it sort of fit into an existing economy, which is there's an annual round that had been burying, hunting, ricing, fishing, and moving from different areas to take advantage of each of those abilities. And in the winter, as land was taken and the ability to hunt was lost, a lot of men would go and work in the camps and then bring that money back to a more communal economy among the Anishinaabe. So sort of replacing hunting with this inflow of capital from the camps. The other thing I found really, or a thing I found really interesting, was the attitudes within the camps, the relationships between Yankee settlers, European immigrants, and the Anishinaabe, which was this sort of racial hierarchy in which the Anishinaabe were always at the bottom. And you see actually a lot of, in racializing, especially the Finns, they would be called Finnish Indians and sort of always placed at this bottom of the scale. And a lot of that scale was determined by skills. Sort of they thought white men were the best workers because they could learn these skills. And the assumption was Anishinaabe were good in the woods, not because they were skilled, which they were, but instead because there was something natural to indigenous people that made them good at being in the woods. So this wasn't a learned skill the way it was for a Yankee. It was instead just the natural ability of someone they considered closer to nature anyway. And so any skill was sort of discounted and put to the side. So it was a really interesting relationship and a deeply tragic story of land and economic loss that's only now, with a lot of land reclamation work being done by the Anishinaabe and the White Earth in particular, beginning to slowly be reversed.
Okay. We are speaking with Willa Hammett Brown. She's the author of the book Gentlemen in the Woods, Manhood Myth and the American Lumberjack. If you have any questions, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can always send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. Right now, we are talking about Gentlemen of the Woods, Manhood, Myth, and the American Lumberjack with Willa Hammett Brown, its author. And we've got a couple people who want to talk to us. So go ahead, Amy in Madison. Amy, are you there? Oh, I don't think so. Okay, let's go on to Oscar in Barron County.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, my dad worked in as a lumberjack for, he said, for three winters. And he was born in 1889. And he never talked a whole lot about it, but he said that he got paid $25 a month. And he worked for 3 months in the winter. And they were expected to be at the site where they were cutting by daylight and didn't leave until dark. And they made $25 a month for 6 days a week. And I assume it was somewhere in about 1920 because he got married in 1921. And I know he said that he spent his whole winter's income to buy a new wedding suit. And so that's why I think it was somewhere around 1921 that he worked as a logger.
Wow. That's a lot of work for one wedding suit.
Yes. That's also, you know, it's around 1920 because about 15 years earlier than that, it would have been less money still. It was about $3.50 to $4 a week. And you would, there were also camps where the term, lumbering has so many fun terms that made their way into our world, but some camps wouldn't pay if they didn't make the contract, if they didn't cut enough wood. So you would have been working just for food, which is where the phrase working for beans comes from.
I saw that and I thought that was so interesting that it did come from that. Speaking of food, we have visions of these lumberjacks being fed all this wonderful food so they could work all day. Your book says no, that's not necessarily the case, was it?
It was a lot of calories. Whether or not it was wonderful is another thing. I mean, you're talking about camps that are often 10, 12 miles from the closest town, and it's sort of once a week or once every 2 weeks, a supply sled is coming through. So things like fresh meat and fresh vegetables really aren't much on the menu. You do get salt meat. There would be meat because it was sort of needed. But in the morning, they have all sorts of wonderful words, sweat pads, which are pancakes. and you would drink that. You'd have your sweat pads washed down with swamp water or blackjack, coffee or tea. Swamp water is tea, blackjack's coffee. And you might have donuts called cold shuts after they're shaped like a certain kind of link in a chain. So a lot of these sort of big carby foods in the morning. At lunch, a wagon called a swing dingle would come out to the woods with a stew normally, or pies, raisin pies usually, or just sort of what we'd call a chess pie now, just a sweet molasses filling. And then dinner would be meat and potatoes. So it's a lot of food. The average lumberjack was consuming between 3,000 and 4,000 calories a day, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily a lot of food you'd want. Especially the further from town you were, you're not exactly getting your winter greens in.
That's for sure. At least they were getting vitamin D out there in the forest every day. Let's go to Stuart in Minneapolis. Go ahead, Stuart.
Hi, I'm calling about a children's picture book. I read with kids at a local school, and this was a good find. It's called Marvin of the North Woods. And the book was done by the granddaughter of Marvin, who at the age of 10 years old lived in Duluth, a Jewish family. And in order to put him out of harm's way from the influenza epidemic, his father, through a connection, had him spend several months way up north at mostly French-speaking lumberjack camp. And it's a lovely view into the life of the lumberjack through the experiences of a 10-year-old city kid. And he keeps kosher, so he works out a very clever way to deal with the diet, and he's clever in arithmetic, so he keeps the books, and he's befriended by the biggest and toughest lumberjack of all. So
that sounds like a great little book.
It sounds like a wonderful book, and I am in Minneapolis, wonderful city, in a Jewish family. So this is all a bunch of stuff I want to know more about.
There you go. It sounds perfect for you. Richard in Madison emailed to say that when he was a youngster growing up in Eau Claire during the 1950s, their Sunday school teacher, Lois Barland, wrote the book Sawdust City about Eau Claire's origins as a lumber mill town on the banks of the Chippewa River. Half Moon Lake and Oxbow Lake formed by the river was a kind of holding pen for the thousands of logs floated down river from further north in the state. When Richard went to college, he worked summers at the local paper mill, still a growing concern at the time.
Yeah, and Eau Claire was right near one of my favorite moments, the Battle of Beef Slaw, it was a place, it just happens to have a great name, but these boom companies who would hold the logs and sort them. And it was a real moment in the 1880s, and Eau Claire was at the heart of it, when the small companies go up against the big concerns, and the big concerns managed to get state government and police behind them and really they worked together to kind of create a group company that drove all the smaller concerns out of business. So that's all really in the Eau Claire region.
Mm-hmm. Amy in Madison, you're up next. Go ahead. Amy, are you there? Oh.
Are you asking for Arnie?
Oh, I'm sorry. Arnie, yes. Go ahead, please.
Okay. I have just a bit of information, a little anecdote about Finnish logging camps. When my grandfather immigrated from Finland, he arrived in Duluth in 1910. And then after he had worked a few months, he sent enough money so my grandmother could join him. I'm on Lynn. They could join him and join, yes. And then they were recruited by a Finnish logging camp owner who then brought them to his logging camp about 65 miles west of Duluth. And she worked as a cook, and my grandfather's a lumberjack. The one difference, though, on the Finnish-operated logging camps is that there was always a sauna, so that the bathing situation was much improved over most of them, even if it was a temporary building or whatever. They always had that, so that made it a very different and valuable sort of resource for Finnish immigrants who were logging.
Absolutely. And a lot of the Finns, a lot of the labor unrest in 1916, the big strike, was organized out of the Finnish Socialist Opera House. And a lot of the Finns took real exception because they were always placed as sort of the lowest of the low and looked down on by everybody. And they would point out, we are the only clean ones. wherever a Finn goes, there's a sauna.
Right.
And they were furious about the sort of racist attitude towards them because they thought everybody else was pretty much disgusting.
Thank you, Arnie. We really appreciate it. Anne emailed to ask how many of the lumberjacks were French-Canadian in Chippewa Falls, for example, and how many of the others were Canadians, I guess? I'm not quite sure what she means. But we talked about Scandinavians, but we had talked about French-Canadians, but what were the mixes up there?
Yeah, Jill, you're from the Canadian part. So the early camps were Yankee stock. They would talk about themselves as Yankee. And that mostly meant they came from somewhere in the northeast of the United States or French Canadians. And then as time went on, the immigration first was a lot were coming from Germany and then eventually the Scandinavians. And then the final wave was really Slavs. Coming from Eastern Europe.
Okay, wonderful. I hate to cut you off there, but we really do have to break it off. Thank you so much, Willa. This was so much fun. We'd love to talk to you again. So thank you for being with us. Willa's book is Gentlemen of the Woods, Manhood Myth, and the American Lumberjack.
Chopped a tree clean down with his forward swing. Got him an
another when his axe swung back that timber cutting thing. He kept on a-chopping the livelong day, and then when it was night, he walked back over the stumps he'd cut and stomped them out of sight.
It Paul, I'm coming, boys.
Paul Bunyan.
For almost 50 years now, a team of researchers have assembled a massive and comprehensive multi-volume history of cartography. This global project has taken place just as technology has transformed the practice of map-making as we know it and the way we see our own world. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show, and our guest, Matthew Edney, director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison, and Osher Professor in the History of Cartography at the University of Southern Maine. So what questions do you have about maps and map making, those who made them, and how they have changed over the ages? Join our conversation, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And Matthew, welcome to The Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go back to the year. It was 1977. It was the first Star Wars movie making it on the big screen. It was the advent of the Apple II computer, ushering in a revolution for personal computing. And it was the launch of the Voyager 2 spacecraft. And it was in this year that the History of Cartography project began. Who started it and what was behind its inception?
Well, it was begun by two gentlemen, a man called David Woodward, who was then at the Newbery Library in Chicago, and he moved up to UW in 1980. And his collaborator, a man called Brian Harley, who was then at the University of Exeter, and he, in 1986, moved to UW-Milwaukee to be closer to David and the project in Madison. And their idea was a four-volume history of cartography, of map-making in all cultures across all periods, that would take four volumes totaling 1 million words and all to be done by 1992. And partly their main concern was to start looking at early maps in a cultural way, to treat maps not just as works of science — they are always works of science — but to also understand them as human works. They're social instruments, they're cultural documents. And to try to have an international team of writers to rethink and to retell the history of maps as human things. And so our primary funder has always been the National Endowment for the Humanities. Huh. National Science Foundation kicked in a fair bit, but NEH was our primary funder. And so, and this generated such a hugely new way of looking at maps that the volumes themselves grew both in number. So the series, when it's complete, will be six volumes. All but one have been published, and the last one just went to press on Friday.
Oh, wow.
And it will take 2 years for it to appear. It's a very large volume because the volumes themselves have grown. Each of the last four volumes are 1 million words unto themselves. And so it takes a lot to get one of those things through press, through copy editing, layout, and all the rest. So it's going to take 2 years. But in 2027, the last volume, volume five in the 19th century, will be done. And David and Brian's vision will be fulfilled.
And Matthew, you have been the director of this project for the last 22 years. And you said, you know, originally this project was supposed to wrap up in 1992 with four volumes. You've surpassed that, and the final volume is still to come in the next year or two. How have you seen the cartography change over that time and the role that the History of Cartography project has played in it?
You know, it's, well, cartography has changed immensely. I mean, you just can't get away from the fact that the digital revolution has thoroughly and completely changed how we make maps and how people relate to maps. You know, in 1977, You mentioned the Apple II came out. From my point of view, it was the Mac in 1984 that really changes things. So my old advisor, David Woodward, I studied with him in the 80s in Madison. He was a self-described font freak. You know, these people who was really into typeface, you know, walking up State Street. It would be critiquing, you know, that typeface doesn't go with that typeface, you know, that's hideous. But nobody else really cared. But it was the Mac in 1984 that made everybody font freak. So now everybody has their favorite typeface.
Sure.
Unfortunately, for some people, it's Comic Sans, but you know, take the whole world.
I don't know anybody for whom it's Comic Sans, Matthew.
Oh, it is. It is. There are people out there. Unfortunately. But anyway, but the Mac and the laser printer, which came out of the park, Xerox PARC Institute, completely revolutionized map making. It brought everything down to the desk. The big mainframe systems of what are called geographic information systems through the 90s got ported down from big mainframes to workstations to desktops. And so now, almost anybody, especially if you're using some of the open source software, QGIS in particular, you can make your own maps. And then all these, with the growth of the internet, there are these web-based mapping systems where you don't even need to buy your own and get into the whole hassle of trying to use these very, very complex data systems. You can make your own maps, almost drop of a hat. And so maps have proliferated. And as big data has proliferated and we have more and more access to reliable data sets, both geographical outlines, but also the statistical data about how people live, we can make all sorts of maps at the drop of a hat. So in many respects, you know, we talk about Web 2.0, for the human interaction of the web. Well, you know, that's cartography 2.0 in a nutshell. And you throw on top of that the rise of satellite imagery, which in the 70s was still photographic film loaded into the satellite before launch and then would be dropped down to Earth in little parachute assemblies to be processed. Well, that all went digital in the 80s. And that's generated a whole nother layer of environmental mapping that has just completely revolutionized the environmental sciences. So to look at the 1970s and what mapping was then, you know, when I was a kid in 1980, I went to college, I was going to be a land surveyor. Huh. And the kind of surveying that I learned, I still learn how to do plane tabling. Plane tabling is where you have basically a yard by a yard plank of wood that you put up on a tripod. And you literally sketch the map as you go, as you're looking at the landscape. When in my last year in 1982-83, I got to use a total station, which is laser rangefinder. And so the person behind the surveyor, the surveying process goes from behind the telescope, the theodolite, where he's looking at various places, and they become the person who's standing there with a little reflector, and they're choosing what sites to pinpoint, and the guy at the telescope is just literally pointing the laser beam to point at that reflector and pressing a button that says measure the time and the angles involved and how that laser beam is going to get to the reflector and back, and that's completely changed how surveyors work as well. Sure. So everything from land surveying, the digital imagery from satellites, the ways we process that information on computers has just completely revolutionized everything to do with mapping.
It's almost hard to fathom. I mean, except unless, of course, you, like Matthew, started with your own yardstick doing your own mapping. And right. I mean, that's how far we've come. And how fast is also a little bit, I would think, would be a challenge when you're trying to document the history of cartography as quickly as it was advancing while you were trying to document it, Matthew.
Well, fortunately, that we end volume six, which came out in 2015. we end that at about 2000, as we're loose in the ends of each period covered. And all the great, so we miss all the huge internet-driven explosion of mapping, fortunately. I once joked we needed a seventh volume. We should have ended volume six about 1980, 1970, and then have a second volume just for digital. But
that doesn't sound like too much of a joke, Matthew.
No.
It sounds pretty serious.
Except we didn't have to fund it. so...
Well, I've got there are a couple of questions here, and I want to invite folks into the conversation with our guest, the direct longtime history of cartography project director, Matthew Edney, and how maps have changed the way we've seen the world and how maps themselves have changed just in our lifetime. 1-800-642-1234 is the phone number to join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We'll start with Margo in Madison. Margo, good afternoon.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you. I just had a comment. GPS is great. I mean, you know, you're out someplace and you don't have to be lost. That's wonderful. But I really am concerned about, especially the young people, growing up without having to learn to navigate an actual map. I mean, when you have the thing in your hands and you're there in the car and you're navigating for the driver, you have to understand north, south, east, west. You have to understand how the interstate system runs across the country and they're numbered in different ways for north, south, east, and west. You have to understand about crossing county lines and you have to understand about bridges that may be out. And you have to learn about the topography of the land that you are in at that moment. And with GPS, you never have that context. And that affects your brain, too, how you think things through, how you plan ahead, how you problem solve. And without maps, I feel like we're losing all of that, aside from the history of what isn't there anymore. So... that was just my comment, but I understand everybody's love of GPS.
Well, I mean, Margo, you make me miss the old Rand McNally Atlas that you keep in the back of the car. And also, you know, the times when you do get lost, you don't even have the chance to get lost anymore. But in the bigger picture of things, how these maps change the way we think, or perhaps with the advent of GPS, how we don't have to, Matthew.
Well, I think... Margo, thank you for your comments. I mean, this is a really important question, and I think it is definitely changing, along with all sort of other ways in which digital technologies are changing how we learn and how we think about the world. But one thing I think you have to be aware of is that GPS and associated mapping practices have actually enabled much more use of navigational tools than there was before. In the paper map, yeah, we had the Rand McNally atlases, or, you know, I've been living in Maine since 95, where we have the DeLorme company, which made by state gazetteers, and everybody in Maine had their favorite gazetteer in the back seat of the car. So when I started in 95, and I asked my students here, how many of you have the state gazetteer, you know, on the back seat of the car, and they would say, you know, about half of my classes would say, yeah, we got it. And they annotate them, you know, with all their favorite swimming holes and fishing points and all the rest. Now I do that, and one person out of 100 might say, yeah, I've got that. And they've all shifted to GPS. So I think on the one hand, there's a massive change in practice. But it's a massive change in practice that hides the fact that so many more people are able to navigate now than they could before.
But is navigation the same? I mean,
navigation is not the same. I mean, Margot's point that you're not looking at a map to figure out the best route, and that helps you, that act of inquiring, of investigating the map, helps you memorize the route and helps you understand space. That's lost by and large, except for those nerds like me who don't use GPS because I want to look at the map and maybe a map on a screen. But, you know, I was driving around southern Wisconsin last Saturday, and looking for bookstores, and my wife, who is directionally challenged, God bless her, was using the GPS to give me instructions, and she sent me the wrong way. And rather than going towards Mineral Point, we ended up by the Mississippi. And
oh, my. Like,
yeah, we went the wrong way. And if I'd been doing it, we wouldn't have done it, but I was driving, so she was navigating. Anyway, there's absolutely a change in practice. Yeah. But it's also a democratization of practice. As long as the GPS and Google Maps or Apple Maps, open source map are free, then anybody can use them. Anybody can access them to navigate. In the same way that now everybody can write. You know, we have all these mechanisms that allow people to write and to get their voice out that you didn't have unless you ran a underground zine or something. You know, the blogs and the internet now have dramatically democratized the ability to get our word out in the same way as democratized our way to understand space. It's just changed the ways we think about space. I will say that for me, teaching old maps and my own research is primarily 18th century. When you're looking at these copper plate engraved maps with beautifully engraved handwriting that my students nowadays have a really hard time with because nobody learned cursive at school anymore. So there's a point where we've got to go through the cursive process.
Yeah.
So the technology is wonderful, but it definitely has its downsides from an historian's point of view.
Matthew Edney is our guest. He is the longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison, almost 50 years old and still going on, with its latest volume expected to be published in the next couple of years. If you have questions about the map making and the history of it and how it's changed and revolutionized, not just the way we see our world, but the way we think and process where we are in it, join us, 1-800-642-1234. Colleen, we'll get to you next, 800-642-1234, or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. Hey, if you're missing Larry today and would like to hear a little more of him, you can always listen to our archives anytime at your leisure at WPR.org/Larry. Larry's back tomorrow, but I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest is the longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison, Matthew Edney. And we're taking a look at how maps have changed over the years and how they changed us in the way we see the world. Conversations available, questions, comments, 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Colleen in Green Bay. Colleen, good afternoon.
Hi. I'm a retired social studies teacher, and I just think maps are great. I always had a map of the week. I had 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, so I went through 3-year cycle. So all my kids, you know, had a different map for 3 years, you know, every week. And the point I'm trying to make is that I think maps give kids a perspective about where they've been or where they're going as far as the land, what rivers. Like in Wisconsin, a lot of the roads that were created were old Indian trails. You know, the highways were created. And, you know, because there's a river here or there's a certain, you know, in the greater part of the United States, a mountain there. And the kids aren't getting that now. I was driving with some people that were like 30 years younger than I was, and I said, they were listening to GPS, and I said, turn here, and they ignored me. and I said, no, really, this is a shortcut. This is going to save us like 20 minutes. And they didn't believe me. I said, I have driven this so many times. They didn't believe me because GPS is telling them to keep going straight. And people are not understanding, you know, spatial directions. They're not getting spatial intelligence. They're losing out, I think, on higher level thinking skills. As a kid, I was the navigator. I would look at the maps. I would help my grandma. You know, we'd drive from Green Bay to Florida, sure, or wherever it was. And as the oldest, I got to do the maps. I think that's why I fell in love with maps. But I just really think that the younger people are really losing out. I never used GPS. I'll go online now, look at a map, I'll write down the directions, I'll print out MapQuest maybe, but no, I will
I don't need GPS.
I had to laugh, Colleen, because I have certainly been in a car where the algorithm has won out over the expert before, and once we got to where we were going, the pretty clear that the expert probably had a better route. But also the bigger picture, again, reiterating, Matthew, how these maps are changing us, but also not just where we're going, but a way to document where we've been and an understanding of where we've been.
Oh, sure. And at this point, I think, and thank you, Colleen, for your point. I do love the idea of printing out MapQuest pages. That's what I used to do. Until I got horribly, horribly lost in Newark, which is the seventh circle of hell, is Newark, driving around Newark Airport, you know. I gave up on even on MapQuest at that point. But the thing about maps are, is that we've, in a modern society, and especially with computer, I think both Colleen and Margot intimate this, we come to treat maps, they might not, but people they know do, as if they are somehow, you know, almost God-given, that they're factual statements about the nature of the Earth. But maps have always been made as human documents for human use. And maps tend to show not so much what the world is, but what the world should be, or what the world ought to be, from the point of view of the makers. Mm. So the boundaries are those of the making community, not those recognized by people on the ground. Same thing with place names. The way that you represent towns is going to vary based on your perspective. There's a wonderful scholar out of Johns Hopkins, like a Richard Kagan, who did this amazing work on Renaissance city views and plans. And he really argues for both an external and an internal perspective. The city is going to look differently if you're making it as a member of that city, of the corporation and the guilds or religious houses, as it would be from outside if you're a royal officer who's going to come in and assess it for fortifications or taxes or whatever it may be. And then what are you trying to actually map and capture? Are you trying to map the built environment, or are you trying to map the city as a community? In the way, you know, the Puritans talked about the city upon the hill they're going to build when they came to New England. And whether you're mapping the urban place, the built environment, or the sense of what's called the civitas, the community, you end up with different kinds of visualizations. And so you have one axis of built to community, and another axis of internal, external. And the result is you can start to fill in this kind of space of knowledge and think, well, you've got straight topographic plans, which are very factual, very external. Nobody inside Madison is, for example, if you're a Madison resident, you're going to sit down and make a map of Madison as if it's a topographic plan. But an outside surveyor will, who's mapping for federal government or the state government, as opposed to a member of a community who's mapping the social community by being part of a parade. And we find that there's very, you know, very set, defined routes that parades take or festivals take, and sequences in which people move in these festivals, these parades, which help define the nature of the community. They help define the space, the communal space of the town, if not the geographical space. And these things are going on today.
Sure.
Maybe not in Madison. I mean, the Fête de Marquette was rained out last week. I was going to go there, but no, I couldn't. It rained out. Anyway, but they are being they do still take place in all the Saints' Day parades around the world, for example. And these are kinds of maps that are not graphic maps; they're performative maps. But they're the kind of maps that even modern societies do on a routine basis that are. Might get ignored in the quest to be very factual and very scientific.
Colleen also brought up something that I'm curious how the History of Cartography Project has incorporated in their work, and that is Native American roads and how indigenous mapping was used.
Indigenous mapping is a really hot topic. Not very many people are doing it because it's difficult to properly negotiate the politics of working with indigenous groups. and taking what are often internal documents to those indigenous peoples. I mean, in the past, you could just blithely disseminate this work, but nowadays we have to be sensitive to this is to the needs and the wishes of the groups. But we actually have a whole separate volume, Volume 2, Book 3, which was published in 1998, and it is freely available. If you don't want to buy it, there are plenty of copies left, but you can also download it for free, all the chapters, from the University of Chicago Press website. In fact, you can do that with all the published volumes. So, good plug. But if you look at Volume 2, Book 3, this is about the indigenous mapping within the historic record around the world. So we have information about Native American mapping and First Nations mapping in North America, Aztec and Incan Amazonian mapping in South America, stuff about pre-imperial Africa, Aboriginal Australia, and so on. And then you've got the larger traditional societies of Asia, which are the subjects of Volume 2, 1 and 2, Book 2, pre-imperial pre-European colonization of India and Southwest Asia and East Asia, have very, very active and vibrant mapping practices. And so, in fact, the History of Cartography volumes have stimulated a huge amount of new research, especially among scholars in China and Japan and India, about their own mapping traditions. So the work that we've done, that was before my time as director, has stimulated so much new work that it's really making the study of maps truly international, truly global.
Matthew Edney, our guest, he is the longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison. Let's go to Ruth in Chippewa Falls next. Ruth, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've been traveling on my own before they had GPS, and I was thrilled to see that I didn't have to do it blindly. So I got a GPS. Well, let me tell you, don't go anywhere without a map, and don't go without looking before you leave, because the GPS will lead you down the merry path.
It is not all-knowing omniscient, is what you're saying, Ruth.
I'm saying it has told me in a cul-de-sac to go off-road.
Well, I'm glad you didn't listen to it.
You know, there are these are really good points, because the data that GPS is using are created by humans, which means there are failure points all the way through the creation of these data sets. The data set, just because they're digital, just because they're maps, doesn't mean that they're utterly trustworthy. And so the number of times people have been directed to turn left not too many fords in this country, but in Europe, there's lots of fords where the road goes through the river. And GPS keeps telling people, turn right and go along the riverbed in the water, you know, which is not very good. That's because the system has not been created as robustly as it could have been, because much of this data is actually coming from paper maps.
Oh, interesting.
The data is not purely digital born. It's getting more so. But so, for example, we mentioned MapQuest. Colleen mentioned MapQuest earlier. MapQuest and then after at Google, the core data for the United States came from maps that had been digitized by the U.S. Census Bureau to keep track of census districts, blocks, block groups, and tracts. And their maps came from each state. So some states had really, really detailed and very precise maps to keep track of the census districts. And some states had less. They didn't put as much money in. And then the maps, these paper maps, are then digitized by the Census Bureau so they could start doing digital mapping of census returns. But they started selling off all the data. And so MapQuest and other people took it and then did a whole bunch of ground truthing. This is where the driving around and testing the data. Is the digital data actually any good? And the testing doesn't necessarily go down every single street. And so you're left with a very variable data set. Now, over the 90s, 2000s, 2010s, that data has been progressively gotten better. But other parts of the world are not based on that, even that kind of data. They're based on digital data, satellite imagery that are being digitized by hand or by computer algorithm, which may or may not be accurate. And as a result, there's all sorts of errors creep in. Yeah. So I'm up there with Ruth. Take a map.
But I let's continue with the questions here, because we continue to add them on, and I'm curious to get your answer, Matthew. John in Madison, we'll go to you next. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm an educator based in Madison, and I agree with a lot of the concerns about digitization that callers have talked about, myself included, who've lost navigation skills as I've aged. But I also think about the possibilities, one of which is related to the issue of time, the temporality. A lot of the exciting mapping I see now and in the future, you know, allows a map not just to be spatial, you know, but to think about each map we see as representing a point in time. Hmm. And that, you know, the dream could be to rewind and fast forward the spatial landscape and help kids and all people, you know, kind of see how the landscape is changing. And I wonder if your guest could kind of talk about that possibility and how he thinks about, you know, maybe a future volume of cartography. We think about it, you know, not just as a spatial profession, but a spatial temporal profession, and what the implications of that might be.
Yeah, John, that is a perfect question for the director of the History of Cartography Project. Matthew?
It's brilliant. That's a great question. Yeah. Thank you, John. So, well, one initial point, and I'll get back to John's particular idea, is an idea that's embedded in a lot of modern 20th century, 21st century ideas about maps, that maps are correct only for the moment when they are made. Mm-hmm. As an historian, I can say that there is maps get used for as long as they are useful, and the question of what is useful is not really necessarily related to the content. So a map can be in use for sometimes hundreds of years, even though the conditions have changed. But the idea of taking maps and animating them, in effect, to show time, we've been trying to do that really since the 70s and 80s. There were people playing with VCR systems and then laser discs, you know, now it's all just straight digital files, trying to take data and get them in a way that we can then show how they change over time. This is really a fun area. I mean, anybody who does map making now will tell you that once you get the data into the right format, then the digital creation of the map is really quite straightforward. It might be an overnight processing or something like that. It's just that getting the data into the right shape so you can do that can take weeks, months. I mean, that's the hard part, is taking varieties of data sets and getting them into the right format so they all align with each other properly. So you can then make a map. That's the real hard part. And if you then add the temporal dimension, not only do we have to get all these different data sets from now to talk to each other, but we also have to get all the data sets from the past, such as they may be. That then adds a level of complexity to the data processing that I think can be really hard to overcome. And then there's the fact of, well, what kind of maps are you working with from the past? Let's say if you want to do a retrospective map, and there are maps, there's some very nice time-lapse maps have been done, for example, showing the growth of the Roman Empire over time and then its collapse, the history of the boundaries of France or the Holy Roman Empire that becomes Germany, those kinds of things. And there's also some very interesting work being done on a much smaller time scale, looking at environmental change. There are some maps in the 18th, even the 17th century, that are really well surveyed of very small parts of the world, parts of coastlines, parts of rivers, and you can start looking at those over time. And in fact, urban historians have done a lot of this with 18th, 19th, and 20th century mapping, where you can see the growth of cities as they've grown and restructured themselves with railroads, especially with trolley cars, and then later on with the automobile and the motorway and airports, you start to get interesting reconstructions of cities. And you can do that over time, and it has been done in a variety of ways. Whether you can actually create an animation for somebody to see, or one of my favorites is to take, a lot of systems do this, you can take two early maps, or an early map and a modern map, and then with a slider, you sort of, as you move the slider back and forth across the screen, you go from the old to the new. And so you can see change between the old, what it used to be like and what it is now. All these things are possible and really quite straightforward once you've got the data into the right system.
Yeah. And John, I appreciate the call. The other question is, with the final volume expected to be published over there, going to the publishers just on Friday, Matthew, of the History of Cartography, what would be the future of this project?
It has no future beyond the publication of the last volume. It was created to print, to produce the History of Cartography series, and that is what it's doing.
Where would you like it to see this research go from here? How does it move forward?
So the series, as I said at the beginning, when David Woodward and Brian Harley began this, the idea was to get people to think about maps in a human way, as human works. And that's been undeniably its effect. Across the board, if you're studying early maps, you're studying early maps in the universe created by the History of Cartography Project. But at the same time, the way that people have studied maps has almost like slingshot past the history. It's taken a long time to get the History Project to where it is now. And the field has moved very much ahead. So the future influence, I think, a future benefit of this series is only going to become apparent when Volume 5 is actually published, because it actually fills the gap between 4 and 6, between the Enlightenment in 4 and the 20th century in Volume 6. But it has the same design as those two volumes. And so finally, people will be able to read across the volumes by looking at the history of property mapping, as opposed to marine charting, as opposed to regional mapping, as opposed to atlas production, as opposed to military map making and use, as opposed to the commercial map trade. We can start looking actually at the history of cartography as it's been practiced, as it's changed over the last three centuries. And that's something we just haven't really been doing, because we haven't had the framework to do it. There's just, people look at the field and they're just blown away by the amount of data that's available. And so everyone's been really happy, and I'm as guilty as anybody else of going in and looking at one map or a set of maps and really working through how this set of map work, how it had influence, how people related to the maps, the history of those maps themselves, political importance or social importance or technical importance at that moment. Now the task is to sit back and actually understand, to really come to terms with the history of mapping rather than the history of cartography, if that makes sense.
Matthew Edney, our guest, director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison, also OSHA professor in the History of Cartography at the University of Southern Maine. And we've still got time for your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. A reminder, if you are interested in the multiple volumes of the History of Cartography Project, they are freely available to everybody online at press.uchicago.edu/books/HOC. Okay, that might be a mouthful, so we've just thrown it up at wpr.org/Larry with the today's episode. So after the show today, you can find that link at wpr.org/Larry. Our guest, Matthew Edney, longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison. And before we took a break there, Matthew, you were talking about the difference between cartography and mapping. And lay that out for us. What is it?
Well, to be honest, I mean, it's rather ironic that here I am as director of the History of Cartography Project. And cartography itself is actually really an idealization. There's no such thing as cartography. I started my last book with a chapter one epigraph. There's no such thing as cartography, and this is a book about it. stealing from a historian of science who wrote that about the scientific revolution. What we think we do is cartography, but what we actually do is mapping. pardon me. We have an idea that cartography and maps are just, maps are all the same. Maps are all replications, reductions of the Earth's surface, and they're factual and technical and scientific. But in reality, the way that we think about the world differs based on our need. So when we think about property, we think about boundaries in the landscape. And the landscape itself doesn't necessarily have to have relief or anything like that. What's important is area and taxable value and ownership. And so there's a whole kind of mapping that is made of property, real property, as opposed to communal property, which has a different kind of mapping. That's all about establishing boundaries and calculating areas and taxing them, as opposed to military mapping, which is all about landscape as relief, as a continuous surface that's crinkly, that has valleys and hills, cliffs, trees, water, places that you can put troops and places where you can't, especially pre-aerial technologies. And so military mapping is a different kind of mapping. It looks at the landscape in a different kind of way to different ends, as opposed to the geographer, as we think of them in the past, who are sitting around in a studio, in an office, taking data from various parts of the world and making maps of the world or maps of continents, as opposed to astronomers who are making maps of the heavens.
Right.
As opposed to the geologist or the sociologist who are making analytical maps, thematic maps of geology or population or class or whatever it may be. And so each one of these different kinds of mapping, different ways of mapping, when you look in the historical record, you start to see that different functions of mapping are entailed with different institutions, both of producing and consuming and using the maps, and they entail different technologies of making and reproducing and accessing the maps. And so in practice, as an academic, rather than just thinking, oh, maps are all the same, as an historian who's trying to understand how maps work within human society and how they shape human thought and how humans use them to do things and to change the world, then is the first thing we have to do is to set aside our modern preconceptions and really look at the different modes of mapping, different ways in which people make maps and use maps. And when you do that, then the history of cartography becomes quite, quite different. It's not just this single narrative of ever better technology, ever more data, ever more accurate data, but it becomes a history of, well, it becomes a history of humanity, how yeah. people engage with the world, yeah. how they change the world, how they understand the world, how they tell other people about the world, but always for that particular reason. Maps are always made for a purpose.
It's almost like a philosophical document about how we see ourselves and the world we're living in that moment. I appreciate that. I want to get to Michael and Madison here before we run out of time. Michael, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to say that I am a map enthusiast. I have hundreds and hundreds of maps.
Oh, wow.
Of all different parts of the country, but particularly Wisconsin and Dane County where I live.
Cool.
And when I heard the topic, I thought, what if I had to pick my three favorite maps, if I have any, that would include an early map of California where the Baja Peninsula is outlined as an island rather than a peninsula.
Huh.
Second would be the eastern part of Tennessee was once slated to become another state named after Ben Franklin. And there are maps that show that. And it's the state was to be called Franklinia. And then coming back to Wisconsin, Iowa County in the southern part of the state it's always been Iowa County as far as I know, but there is a map with an error where Iowa County is labeled as Montgomery County. And that's just a pure simple error. There's no historical relevance to that, but those are hard maps to find. And I just absolutely love maps. And I thank you again for taking my call. I'll listen for the discussion.
Well, wait, before you go, Michael, I'm wondering where the Iowa County, Montgomery County map came from, because that would, who was responsible for such an egregious error?
You know, I can't tell you for sure. I mean, I haven't looked at my map collection in a long time because I'm actually a compulsive collector. I collect books and microscopes and all the art and all different kinds of stuff.
The state of Franklinian, the island of the California Baja, and the Montgomery County of Wisconsin. Those are unique maps. And Matthew, I imagine you probably have some of your own that are your favorites.
I do, and I should actually just say California as an island is a long-running idea.
Oh, wow.
It's actually not just Baja California. It's everything up to San Francisco and the Golden Gate. Because some guys in Europe in about 1670 had this idea, well, we got the Colorado River and you got the Golden Gate, and maybe they're actually connected. So everything from San Francisco south becomes this island that is rejoined by the French in about 1700.
Wow. And
the whole story about that. I have, as I like to say to my students and colleagues, I have many favoritist maps. But I think of all, I have two favoritist maps, most favoritist maps. One is there's a early map of the coast of what becomes New England by John Smith of Pocahontas fame and, you know, all that stuff. After Virginia, he did a brief expedition in 1614 to what is now New England, and he made a map. And that's one of my favorites because I got three peer-reviewed articles and a book out of it. So clearly it says something to me, mostly how badly people have interpreted it, which requires a whole new interpretation. But my really absolute all-time favoritist map, favoritist of all the favoritist maps, is a map made by Mark Twain in September 1870. When the Prussians are about to invest Paris at the high point of the Franco-Prussian War. Emperor Louis has been captured at Verdun, and the French army is just a complete mess. It's when the Commune rises up and all sorts of things are going on. And it's a very long story. Mark Twain decides to mock these incredibly ornate and precise maps of the defenses of Paris that are appearing in the New York newspapers and in his own newspaper, the Buffalo Explorer, to print this absurdist map, which is even more absurd because he cut it in a wood block. He cut the block right reading, so it looked right to him as he cut it. Because when it printed, it printed wrong reading. So all the text is incorrect.
Matthew, and, I apologize. Yeah. We're just about out of time here, but I want to thank you, and what a perfect way to land with Mark Twain's backwards map that was printed for his paper and others. Just a fascinating way to see the world through the history of cartography. Matthew, thank you for sharing it with us today.
You're entirely welcome. Thank you.
Matthew Edney is the longtime director of the History of Cartography Project at UW-Madison, as well as a professor in the History of Cartography at the University of Southern Maine. And thank you for being a part of the show today. It's a team effort, as always, with our producers Clara Neipert and Joel Patenaude, our technical director Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau, and I'm Lee Rayburn in today for, of course, Larry Mueller. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.